You're about to join Niels Kostrup Larsen on a raw and honest journey into the world of systematic investing and learn about the most dependable and consistent yet often overlooked investment strategy. Welcome to the Systematic Investor Series.
Welcome or welcome back to this week's edition of the Systematic Investor Series with Alan Dunn and I, Niels Kostrup Larsen, where each week we take the pulse of the global market through the lens of a rules-based investor. Alan, wonderful to be back with you this week. How are you doing?
Very well. Thanks, Niels. Great to be back.
I saw Dublin was a busy place last night. I was watching some kind of European football championship game, and I thought of you, actually, since it was going on in Dublin.
That's right, just up the road here in the Aviva Stadium. So very busy around the area yesterday afternoon, and lots of security and personnel, but I think it all went off very well. So
absolutely. Italians won, as I understand it. All right, well, I'm sure people didn't tune in to listen to us talk about football, but you never know. We've got a few other topics to tackle today, but as you know, I always love to start out with sort of something that's been on your radar, come across your desk, or your sort of that you picked up and you think is interesting that's going on outside the topics we're going to be talking about.
Yeah. I guess it's a couple of months since I've been on. Equities dipped down in April and then recovered, and you know, we had Nvidia results last night, and the AI boom seems to be very much intact. You know, stellar results on the revenue side and very favorable forward guidance. So I think, you know, interesting, that's still probably the big theme, or well, one of the big themes in markets. But one of the things that came onto my radar in the last month or so, which I thought was really interesting, it got some attention, but I thought maybe warranted a bit more, was an article in the Wall Street Journal that it's called Trump Allies Draw Plans to Blunt Fed's Independence. And it was around a report that came out that some of Trump's advisors were drawing up plans to basically says that the president would be more instrumental in Fed decisions should Trump come into office. I mean, reading the article, it's not clear how close these people are to Trump. There was a bit of suggestions that they may not be, you know, kind of his immediate advisors. But that said, even those people who have talked to Trump on the issue, evidently, according to a report, were suggesting that there was a desire to blunt the Fed's independence and, you know, be a bit more influential on rates, which, you know, obviously doesn't surprise any of us to hear that, I think. And if you go back to the last time Trump was in office, he was certainly vocal in calling for lower rates and at times a weaker dollar as well. So I think, you know, the article did point out that it's not clear legally if Trump could actually, demote Jerome Powell. He possibly could, but he would still be a governor on the board, so he'd still be there. And there's no new appointments up until 2026. But that's, you know, it's not that far away. I mean, you know, kind of we'd be talking about this in 18 months' time. So it's interesting. And I think just more generally, are we entering into an era of where maybe of less central bank independence? You know, the whole idea of central bank independence isn't that old. You know, you go back to the early 90s in the UK, it was still, you know, as of the mid-90s, the Treasury used to meet with the Bank of England and decide together. And then you had, you know, full independence. And, you know, throughout history in the Fed, you've had episodes where the Fed chair has been influenced, you know, famously Arthur Burns, I guess, you know, the Fed, Nixon kind of planted stories about Arthur Burns in the press to try and influence him and undermine him. And even prior to that, you know, you go back to World War II, the Fed had basically bought bonds and did yield curve control to facilitate the war effort. So I think structurally it is something that we may hear more and more about going forward is, you know, will we see more coordination between fiscal and monetary policy? And could that mean less central bank independence? Obviously, if you make kind of blunt decisions of trying to interfere, you know, it could have adverse consequences. You would have thought it would be a dollar negative and a higher bond yield. So there are reasons not to go down that route. But that's not to say somebody like Donald Trump mightn't do that anyway.
No, I mean, I think what's kind of disturbing about things like that, or surprising that it can even be entertained, is, of course, that often you see the West criticize countries in the East for being too, you know, governed by very few people. So I think it's a really bad idea if the West now starts to go in the same direction, let alone a president who managed, for reasons I don't quite understand, to hold on to his own business empire while he was president, because normally they have to sell all their assets so there is no influence, so to speak. So it raises a lot of questions. Unfortunately, sometimes these stories and these intentions, there's a little bit more validity to them when they come out. And as you rightly said, it's not something that is completely new, but not something that I would hope comes to fruition. Couple of questions for you on the topics. By the way, I'm not at all, I know very little about individual equities, and certainly AI stocks like NVIDIA for sure. But you know, there's obviously, as you say, another another set of accounts that kind of beat estimates and all of that stuff yesterday. And a lot of focus is on their data centers. Now, people might think, well, data centers, that doesn't sound very AI-ish. But is this the way most people actually get access to their GPUs, which are the ones they, as far as I understand, are very beneficial to AI computing or whatever we call it?
I don't know, to be honest. I just briefly scanned the results this morning, and you know, the headlines were all about the big beat on the revenue side, and then the very favorable forward guidance, and and basically.
No, it's just because from what I've seen, a lot of their revenue is actually data centers. It comes from data centers, which of course runs, I'm sure, their own GPUs in that sense. Anyways, I wanted to go a slightly different route on AI, just something, you know, again, when you say, what have you picked up in the last week? Well, I did pick up, and I'm not an AI expert, clearly, but I did notice another two leading people have left OpenAI, resigning from the company. So one is one of the co-founders, actually, Ilva Sutskever or something like that, as far as I recall. And the other one, someone called Jan Leike, I don't know. He was a co-leader of something called the Super Alignment Group. Now, the reason I mention that is what I find interesting is that from the news reports is that it seems like they are resigning because they have concerns about the direction of where it's going, obviously spearheaded by Sam Altman, in terms of the AI's alignment with human interests. Now, why I find that interesting is, if you remember 6, 7, 8 months ago, Sam Altman was kicked out of the company, there was a big revolt, everybody sort of resigned and all that stuff. Around that same time, we were actually doing a podcast recording with someone who's very well plugged into Silicon Valley. And I remember off the record, he was saying, because we were kind of curious, saying, well, what's the real reason here? And at the time, we were told that that Sam Altman had actually, and maybe that is what's this Super Alignment Group or whatever, I don't know what it is, but he's managed to put together two groups of researchers that had finally cracked some AI stuff that means that suddenly it took a big leap forward in terms of what it could do, which is kind of the beginning of when you start getting concerns about what it then could do on its own. I don't know if it never came out as such that was the reason for it, but these kind of resignations coming out, to me at least, not being an expert, sounds like the original reason probably could have been correct, that there are some concerns about the what we're being told, maybe what the board was being told at the time by Sam Altman. Of course, pure speculation on my side, but interesting. Anyways, the final thing I just wanted to bring maybe to your attention, which I'm sure has not escaped you, is that we're going to have another election very close to you in the UK, but we're also very soon going to have European elections. Now, a lot of our listeners are outside Europe, so it may not mean so much, but there is a current at the moment happening, at least in the polls, where there is somewhat of a meaningful swing to the right in many of the larger countries. And with the way the European Parliament is constructed, you only need some of the big countries like Germany, France, maybe Spain, pushing to the right, and then suddenly the whole parliament gets a different constellation. Is this something you think investors should be thinking about?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I interviewed Gary Gerstle recently, so that's going to be coming out soon. And his book is called "The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order," and it's all about, you know, how we've seen this shift in global politics in the last decade in response to some of the failings of neoliberalism, you know, the market model, etc. I suppose it's interesting. It hasn't just been a shift. You might have expected a shift, you know, away from the right to the left in the sense that, you know, free markets haven't been perfect. So would you see a move back towards more socialism, etc.? And you've seen that to an extent, obviously, with Bernie Sanders, etc. But equally, you've seen a rise of the extreme right, as you say. So it's kind of both on both sides. You're seeing traction both on the left and on the far right. Obviously, in the UK, as you say, there's an election coming up, you know, widely expected to be a Labour win, you know, based on the polls at the moment. But even Labour are probably kind of have migrated more to the centre. Certainly in Europe, you know, in Germany, I think it's AfD have been making ground. Now, there've been a bit of controversy there. I just saw something this morning. One of their candidates made some comments and he's had to step down. So, I mean, I think there's a bit of fragmentation there. But certainly, yeah, the rise of nationalism has been one of the fallouts of this, of, I guess, the decline of the neoliberal order. So, yeah, definitely interesting to see how that plays out in the elections coming up in June.
And for those of us where maybe we're not so completely up to date on our neoliberal orders, but just to be sure I understand it, the neoliberal order was this thing about, yeah, we should all open up and trade with everyone, invite China into the World Trade Organization.
It's kind of the word neoliberalism can be quite somewhat confusing for people because you've got liberalism as well, and liberals tend to be more kind of Keynesian, I guess, whereas neoliberalism is more just a belief in the free markets and in free trade and all of those. It's kind of linked to, you know, what was called the Washington Consensus, which was similar, you know, free trade, globalization, and all of that. But you know, the whole theme of his book is how that has been repealed, and the question then is what comes next. So,
I can't wait for that conversation to come out because I've heard him once before, and he's very captivating to listen to. So I'm very curious about that. All right. Okay. Well, we're going to stay with kind of the world as our playground, because we normally, when we're together, at least on the podcast, we talk about some of your global macro thoughts, observations. And I know you've brought a few topics, so I'll let you jump in where you want and talk about some of the things you find interesting at the moment in that part of the financial world.
Yeah, there's just a couple of things I thought had been interesting on that side. And obviously, you know, taking a step back, you know, where is the picture at the moment? Obviously, looking at the US, economic growth still solid. Obviously, Q1 was a little bit weaker, but that was primarily kind of biased down by inventories and trade. But the underlying kind of domestic demand is still very solid there. But I think, you know, fair to say maybe the growing sense that there might be some cracks appearing. I mean, people are always pointing to cracks. But one thing I saw recently, which was interesting, was a study from the San Francisco Fed, and they were looking at the whole area of excess savings again. And you remember, you know, during the pandemic, we had a lot of checks issued in the US and stimuluses. And so people accumulated a lot of savings. And if you think about, you know, what the reasons for why the economy has been robust in the face of higher rates, there's been maybe three or four arguments. One has been everybody's refinanced at lower yields, so higher yields haven't mattered because everybody's locked into low rates. Secondly, you know, the variable lags, long and variable lags of monetary policy. So that's still there. We don't know how long the lags are. We could still see the impact of higher rates. I think the third reason has been kind of the much stronger fiscal support, and that's still there and hasn't gone away. And then the fourth one is probably this excess savings, that the consumer balance sheets were really strong and consumers were able to tap into these accumulated savings. And that's reflected in the savings rate in the US has come down to about 3%, whereas pre-pandemic was about 6%. So people are saving less out of current income and drawing down their savings. Now, the interesting thing is, you know, people have been monitoring this, wondering when are these excess savings going to run out? There's a bit of, you know, uncertainty being around the calculations. You have to make assumptions around kind of trend levels. But as I say, the latest piece from the researchers at San Francisco Fed, they were estimating that, that those savings had now run out. And they were being drawn down at a rate of about, I think it was about $80 billion a month. So quite a decent amount. So, the guts of $1 trillion on an annualized basis, which would be, over 3% of GDP. So question is, is this the tipping point, that we had that stimulus there? I think there is a sense that maybe at the lower level of the income levels, we are certainly seeing that stress, delinquencies in terms of credit cards, auto loan repayments, all of those are ticking higher. But obviously the middle and upper classes are still doing fine. The labor market is still reasonably solid, and obviously wealth effects as well. So there are these conflicting factors, but certainly from a risk perspective, the point I think is interesting is that you would certainly say maybe the economic risks are starting to mount again because of these excess savings is declined. But at the same time, if you look at markets, you're seeing the opposite. Like if you look at bond yields and corporate bond spreads, so BBB spreads, I was looking at over treasuries at the low, nearly all time low, certainly the lowest pre-pandemic or as low as we saw back in 2007. If you look at things like the VIX, very low. So risk very much priced very low. And even I was listening to Chris Waller speaking during the week, he was saying, the risk of recession seems to have been totally removed from markets. So just at the point where you could see maybe actual reasons for why we might see a downturn coming on the consumer side, risk being priced very, to not reflect that at all. So that was one thing I thought was interesting. As I say, I was listening to the Chris Waller speech earlier this week, and looking at the aggregate of all the Fed comments, I think the general view, we also had the minutes out, the general view has been that the Fed's a bit more hawkish now, reflecting the data. One of the things that Chris Waller, he was quite defensive. There's been this accusation that the Fed's become too data dependent and flip-flopping too much, and he was quite dismissive of that. But I think the problem the Fed made was kind of being very keen to say that we're going to cut rates last December, without having the ammunition to do that. And when I read and listened to his speech, I didn't think it was so hawkish. I mean, he was basically saying, that a rate hike from his perspective is still very unlikely, and that even though he only gave the kind of the inflation reports we've seen recently, a C+, as he put it, not an A or a B, he still thought that the next move would probably be a cut. Interestingly, he said, in the absence of a significant weakening in the labor market, he would need several months of good inflation. But it was interesting that so there's two things that could prompt obviously rate cuts here. Obviously, if inflation comes down, or if we see significant weakness in the labor market, that they could cut rates anyway, which is kind of interesting because there is this view, amongst economists that we'd have to see higher unemployment to get inflation down. That's the kind of the Phillips curve idea. But he's saying, well, if you started to see the labor market weakening, they'd obviously cut rates anyway, which I think we all know. But interesting that we got that confirmation. So they were two of the interesting things. But certainly the key takeaway I would say is certainly on the consumer side, probably more of a focus now, given that we've seen that trajectory on the excess savings, and interesting how markets are not really pricing that recession risk to any extent at all these days.
Now, clearly you follow these things much closer than I do. But when I hear you talk about it like that, something in me tells me that we have actually seen a big shift in central bank policy. I mean, I seem to remember many years ago, a couple of decades ago maybe even, that central banks, when they came out, they were kind of giving us a kind of a forecast. They were forward-looking. They were steering us in a certain direction. Obviously, we had the dot plots, which I don't even mean that, but I just generally speaking about the narrative, the way they handled media, the way they handle everything. And now it's all month by month data driven stuff, which in itself to me actually creates, and I don't think that's really what they want, but it creates uncertainty. It creates ambiguity about where we're going. I was just about to swear there, but I didn't mean to. But so it's kind of interesting. It's almost like they're defeating their own purpose in the way they have shifted the way they do things. I don't know if you've kind of
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's because they've lost confidence in their models. You know, obviously the models didn't work during COVID, and so they didn't forecast the extent of the inflation spike. So now they've lost, a bit of credibility. So, I mean, the way central bankers conducted policy going back 4 or 5 years was you had a forecast of where inflation was going to be in 2 years' time, and, you had a fan charts around that, as you used to see in the Bank of England report, so you probably still do. But that was the primary, no point in responding to no point in responding to the most recent inflation number, because obviously that doesn't reflect the impact of policy. So you want to be forecasting where the rate is going to be in 2 years' time and respond to that. But that's totally gone out the window now, because they can't afford to get it wrong again. So in theory, they would say, okay, the next move is down because our forecast is for lower inflation. But at the same time, they don't have the confidence to stick to that, because they know, basically the margin of error around their forecast is so great. And even, Ben Bernanke was brought into the Bank of England to do a review. And, he's kind of saying, they need to, rather than just have these point estimates and even the fan chart, to talk more about scenarios. But how useful is that? I mean, Chris Waller talked about that a bit. I mean, you could talk about every scenario under the sun. If inflation's higher, we're going to raise rates. If inflation's lower, we're going to cut rates. How useful is that? So I think they are a little bit rudderless at the moment. And because of that, as you say, they're literally, and even what was interesting, like Chris Waller was pointing out that, they're reacting to the second decimal place on the inflation number, like whether it's kind of 0.29 or 0.35, which is, and these numbers are just, they're an estimate, they're a sample. So they're not the actual inflation number. It's just, it's their best estimate based on, I don't know, call it 1,000 prices or 2,000, whatever it is, out of the aggregate number of prices in the economy. So there's huge, and there's seasonal adjustments and all of that. So I think you're right, but it just reflects the fact of the mistakes that have been made in the last couple of years means that they're hypersensitive to getting it wrong again.
Anyways, time will show. Speaking of downturns, it's still a little bit of a downturn in trend following performance so far in May. So a bit soft, not least, of course, because we've had some meaningful corrections, among others, in the soft sector. Cocoa down about 20% so far in May. But I think actually probably what's hurting sort of trend followers in general, more so than just a single market like cocoa, energies, grains, interest rates. I think we've seen some decent reversals in those. For example, net gas is up 40%, certainly against the prevailing downtrend that we've seen for quite a long time. We've seen some offsets of those losses, mostly I think in metals, where for a change silver is grabbing the headlines, so that's shining a bit more than its cost in gold, and also of course equities, based on this AI craze and other things, are doing pretty well. Anything from your side, Alan, anything you've noticed about trend following performance this year, maybe so far?
No, I mean, we'll get on to later. Obviously, something to talk about is, it's been a great start to the year in a pro-risk environment. So it's the kind of the side of the trend following equation that people forget about, obviously, with all the talk of crisis risk offset and risk mitigation. But we'll talk about that in a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, cool. So as of yesterday, my trend barometer finished at 66. That's a pretty good, strong reading. So maybe there's more recovery to come leading into the end of May. As of Tuesday evening, because Alan and I are recording actually Thursday to this week, The numbers are a little bit down for the various indices, which I'll come to, but I will just throw in and say yesterday, Wednesday, was a down day for CTA, so they'll probably be a little bit worse than the numbers I mentioned here. Beta 50 is down about 1% in May, up still 10.44% for the year. SocGen CTA index down 62 basis points, but still up 11.18% for the year. SocGen trend down 91 basis points, up 13.25% for the year. And bucking the trend, the short-term traders index up 48 basis points and up 4.06% so far this year. In contrast, traditional markets doing well. MSCI World up 4.85% so far as of yesterday, and up 9.35% so far this year. World government bonds are up another 85 basis points so far this month. And the S&P 500 up 5.52% as of Wednesday evening, up 11.89% so far this year. All right, as you alluded to, and we are going to talk a little bit about some strategies closely related to trend following as well as trend following. And the first paper that we're going to be talking about is something that came from our friends over at SocGen, the Quant Macro paper that was released very recently. So why don't you take us into that world and what their findings were?
Yeah, so it's a paper on quant macro heterogeneity and exposure to trend from David Regan at SocGen. And I mean, it's an interesting topic from the perspective of anybody who's allocating across different managed future strategies and how they blend together. And this is focused on quant macro. And I guess when we're talking about quant macro, you know, it's strategies where the price inputs are fundamentally based, either using market data or, you know, actual economic data. And, you know, obviously these types of strategies can be either directional in nature or more relative value. And, you know, the whole quant macro space, I think it's fair to say, was quite popular going back maybe a few years. And then, you know, in a period where trend following was struggling, but maybe trend following has come back to the fore. But still, from my own perspective, I would see more and more managers have had dedicated systematic macro or quant macro programs in the last number of years. It's certainly a distinct universe that is worth monitoring. So basically what they're trying to figure out here is, you know, are these quant macro managers broadly doing different things, or are they doing all kind of similar things? I mean, that's the basic question that they're trying to assess. And also then, to what extent are they different from trend followers? And so they look across, I think they have 83 programs that they have data on. Later on in the second part of the study, they use about 24 of them, and they're all systematic, all using fundamental inputs, and it's only one program per manager. And certainly, you know, at a high level, you do see more heterogeneity in the space. They look at the average pairwise correlation of these programs, these quant macro programs, and it's 0.16. And that average pairwise correlation has actually been trending down over time. So to put that in context, the average pairwise correlation of trend followers is 0.58, so which actually slightly less than I would have expected, so it might have been even a little bit higher. But generally, you know, trend followers are heavily influenced by one factor, the trend factor, whereas obviously in the quant macro space, you have more, and it, you know, that sounds to me, more differences. Why? Because some are relative value, some are directional, they'll use different types of models, different inputs, etc. So there is more, I suppose, potential to be different. And then the second thing is that they use principal component analysis to try and explain the returns and try and understand, like, what are the factors that are driving the returns in the quant macro space. And as I say, for that, they use 24 programs looking back over the last 5 years. And what they found is, so with principal component analysis is you're trying to find factors that explain the variance of returns, and then each additional factor is uncorrelated with the previous factor. And then what you're looking at is how much each factor can explain the variance of returns across the managers. And what they found here is that PC1, the first principal component, explained 24% of the variance across the universe. And then PC2, the second principal component, explained an additional 13%. So that's, I mean, again, to put that relative to trend followers, if you were to do the same analysis for trend followers, PC1 for trend followers explains 57% of the variance in returns, and PC2 a lot less. So again, it's highlighting the fact that quant macro are more different. The question is, what is PC1? And PC1, you know, you can actually correlate that to trend following. So you can actually figure out that PC1 is actually probably a trend factor, and PC2, they figure out, is actually an equity factor, or actually the way they find it, it's a negative correlated to the equity world, but you'd obviously have a positive or a negative sensitivity to that factor. So it's effectively equities. So what that is telling you is that a couple of things. One, quant macro programs are more diverse. Two, they are picking up an element of trend. But actually, if you look at the correlation to trend, it varies, which is what you expect. Because if you think about it, if you're a quant macro manager, at times you might pick up on a similar trend as a trend follower. And actually, a lot of these, some of these quant macro firms are multi-strat, so they actually have a small element of trend following in there. And obviously, at times, just by chance, you're going to have the same positions as trend followers as well. But I thought it was interesting in kind of confirming that there is a lot of diversification potential within the space, which is what you would expect. But also that if you look across the quant macro managers, quite a varying degree of sensitivity to the different factors and to trend. So from an allocator's perspective, I think what's interesting is if you're constructing kind of multi-manager portfolios or multi-strat portfolios, certainly blending trend with quant macro, you would expect, has benefits, but there's a couple of things that you kind of have to be cognizant of, and that is like looking in to see what are you picking up additional trend with this within this program, and how much, and you would infer that from the correlations and the principal component analysis as well, and then obviously, you know, it's a different type of exposure as well, so you know, you have to be cognizant of concentration risk and stuff like that, particularly in the quant macro space. But pause there. I thought it was interesting, short paper and kind of highlighting probably what I would have expected, but interesting to see that the results kind of validate my expectations.
Couple of questions for you on this, given your background. What do you think is harder as an allocator to analyze and picking a manager? A trend follower or a quant macro fund? What do you think actually is harder of the two?
It's hard to say what it's hard. I mean, what the data is showing you is obviously that there's probably more unique factors driving the performance of somebody in quant macro. They will different types of models and different inputs. Whether it's harder to pick the manager or assess them, I don't know. I think they present different challenges with quant macro. You know, what are the risks or the pitfalls there? You know, sometimes, particularly if managers are using relative value strategies, you can have quite concentrated individual exposures. You can have, because it's, you know, relating markets to economics, you can have relationships there that can break down. You know, obviously we saw during COVID, you know, markets moving ahead of the fundamentals because, you know, they were anticipating lockdowns, which is not something you would see in economic data. So you always have these risks of kind of structural shifts, changing macro relationships, RV exposures. And I think another challenge with quant macro is knowing, you know, the environment when it's going to work for you, because with trend following, you know very clearly when it's going to work. If we see big moves in markets, trend following will do well, and probably most trend followers will do. Obviously, trend followers will do well to differing degrees, but I think you have a pretty good sense on in what type of environment a certain type of trend follower is going to do well. Whereas that's less the case, I think, with quant macro, particularly if it's kind of multi-strat or V as well. You know, you're kind of extracting risk premia, you're capitalizing on lead lag relationships. Yes, I think you can have conviction that the manager can generate returns over time, but harder to say when it's going to work. So I think there's some of the challenges. Whereas with trend followers, you know that there's an underlying characteristic to the strategy that will work in a certain set of circumstances, and it's trying to figure out what are the differences between the different managers. So I wouldn't say one is more easier or difficult, but it's, they said they present kind of different challenges, I'd say.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, let's move on, but staying with kind of a different type of strategies, because there was also a family office report that came out, the 2024 UBS family office report came out, that you, I think we both actually noticed that. You probably read it more carefully than I did, so I'm going to let you lead again. Maybe we talk a little bit about what the highlights were to begin with, and sort of how family offices are looking to allocate assets at the moment.
Yeah, so this is from UBS, and they survey 320 single family offices with an average net worth of $2.6 billion, so 600. They say 600 billion of wealth in aggregate. So, you know, a significant cohort and, you know, presumably representative of the median kind of family office. I mean, from an asset allocation perspective, some slight differences actually between the average across the world and the US, but in terms of the global average, 28% exposure to public equities, 22% to private equities. So combined, 50% fixed income, 19% real estate, 10% hedge funds, only 5%, and no line item to manage futures and trend following. So I was surprised on the back of some recent Top Traders Unplugged episodes where 60% was being mentioned, that the number was so low, but at the same time, not shocked to see it at such low levels. Private debt was only 2%, so that was another surprising one, and given all the chat we've heard about private credit, private debt, and commodities. Commodities was zero, I think, which I was amazed to see. Maybe the view is you're picking up commodity exposure elsewhere. But, I imagine that's kind of a little bit cyclical I would guess if you went back, maybe 10, 15 years ago, certainly you would have had a higher allocation to commodities, and then small allocations to things like gold and art and collectibles and things like that. So maybe not as equity centric as you might have thought. The fixed income at 19%, a little bit probably high, maybe from the perception of family offices as being long-term investors and not overly worried about kind of drawdowns to the same, as maybe other investors, as this is multi-generational wealth. There had been a notable increase in allocation to fixed income in the last year. And obviously that, I guess, reflecting the fact that yields have gone up and fixed income is more interesting, but at a high level, they would be the main points.
And you know what I mean by my next question, but people might be a little bit surprised when I ask: any allocation to whiskey?
not picked out specifically. So obviously, we spoke to Tad Fallows from Long Angle on the Allocator series recently, and so he runs a group. It's kind of a community of investors, but they're all high net worth, ultra high net worth. Younger investors, I understand, but they would be kind of family office type investors as well. It's interesting if you compare what they've found surveying their members, they were at about 60% across public and private equity, so a little bit higher than this UBS report, and then 35% in alternative assets, 30-35, and then I think about 10% in cash and fixed income. So lower on cash and fixed income, a bit higher in public and private equity, and then higher in alternative assets. And some of the things he talked about were more esoteric investments like whiskey aging, which is buying kind of 1 year bourbon and holding it till it becomes 5 year, and then you're able to sell it on. So interesting, I hadn't come across that one before, but no specific mention of whiskey. But interesting, I would say. Yeah, a little bit. His group are probably a little bit more higher in terms of the risk appetite, and reflecting that, a little bit lower on the fixed income side.
Yeah, he was trading the whiskey curve, I think, the 1-5 year type.
That's right.
Stuff.
Yeah.
But also importantly, his organization, and I think maybe certainly him himself, very interested and very pro trend following.
That's right.
Actually, yeah. In the world we live in today.
Yeah.
Actually, on the topic of trend following, the next topic that you brought along, which I thought of was interesting. I don't know where I came across the same thing very recently. It could have been the same source as you, of course, but it's a different way of thinking of trend following. We have always talked about it, or not always, but we talk a lot about it as a, in lack of a better word, a crisis alpha strategy. And then you brought up this topic about trend following as a return enhancement overlay instead. So very curious to hear where we're going to go with this topic.
Yeah, well, a couple of things I suppose I've been thinking about. One, as we've said, you know, this has been a very good year for trend following to date, and it's we're in a pro-risk type environment. And then obviously, you know, we're seeing from the likes of the UBS report there, people not allocating as much to trend following as we would kind of expect. And, you know, so partially linked to that, you know, I was thinking, are we missing that kind of that piece of the argument around trend following? Obviously, you'll find plenty of articles on the benefit of trend following as a risk mitigation strategy and crisis risk offset, but not much on this characteristic of what trend following can do for you in a pro-risk environment. So I was thinking, do we need something like, what's the opposite of crisis risk offset? It's return enhancing overlay or something like that to highlight this characteristic. And if you think about it, like what are the characteristics of trend following and a trend following portfolio? You know, they're systematic, agnostic between long and short, highly diversified, you know, kind of links to those characteristics that Katie Kaminski talked about in terms of what are the characteristics that allow these strategies to deliver crisis alpha. And those kind of characteristics are valuable in times of stress. Why? Because they can, you know, reduce, you know, get you short equities, get you long bonds, can get you into positions in commodities and FX that can be a source of diversification. And all of that we understand, and all of those arguments have been well made over time. But equally, those characteristics are valuable in a pro-risk environment as well. If you think about it, you know, big challenge now is deciding how to be positioned in equities. Obviously, the trend is up. We've had a long run. Valuations are high-ish, you know, fairly high in some instances. There's risks, you know, I'm talking about cracks appearing in the economy, but there's always cracks, there's always risks. So what do you do? How do you decide when it's time to jump off the equity bull market? So very hard to do that. So, you know, obviously having exposure to trend following is advantageous in this environment as well, from the perspective of giving you that equity exposure, but then having mechanical rules for determining when to reduce that exposure. Obviously, if the trend starts to turn down, so you know you're going to get out and your portfolio exposure to equities will be reduced under a certain set of circumstances. And in an environment like this, interestingly, we're seeing strong trends in other markets as well. So something I said, I wanted to have a look at the data. And I think it also links to, you know, the idea of, you know, return stacking, which we've been talking about as well. And does that make sense? And I think there is a place for it in terms of when you stack trend following on top of passive equities, you are getting this kind of, it's an overlay. It's a mechanical overlay of modulating your, not just your equity exposure, but also your exposure to other assets as well. So I looked at historically the returns on the S&P 500, and I added an overlay of the SocGen trend. So this would be kind of a return stack type portfolio. So adding a 30% exposure to the ST trend excess return, which is what you could achieve on a kind of a notionally funded basis. And that gives you the same volatility as the S&P 500. So you have two portfolios, S&P or S&P plus S&P plus SocGen trend overlay. And the results are interesting. I looked at calendar quarterly returns since 2000. And what you actually find is definitely in the bottom decile quarters for the S&P, having the overlay is beneficial. So we all know that. That's what everybody has written at length on this. But actually in that was the bottom quartile. In the top quartile as well, the combined strategy is better as well. So it's not just in the crisis periods that you get the benefit, but you get the benefit in the crisis periods and in the very favorable periods. And actually in the middle periods, it underperforms a bit. So it's kind of like we all have seen that chart before of the smile of, you know, you plot S&P versus Soc Gen trend, and it is a smile type return. And in the very favorable and in the very negative periods for S&P, so trend following tends to do well. But you kind of forget that. And it's easy to make arguments around, you know, in crisis periods, we do tend to see trends, you know, bonds will rally, you know, currencies often, whatever it is. Yeah. But also it does seem to suggest that in the very favorable periods for equities, you tend to see more trends as well. Presumably because if equities are doing very well, the economy's hot. So we're seeing probably moves in commodities just as we're seeing at the moment. So now, interestingly, the magnitude of the difference is greater on the downside. So when the combined portfolio does do relatively better in the worst period. So maybe that's a reason why we haven't acknowledged this aspect of trend following to the same extent. But I do think it is something that's been lost a little bit in the marketing of trend following, that it's not just crisis risk offset, that there is this return enhancing overlay benefit as well, which we might hear more about going forward.
Yeah, no, I love the idea. I love the idea of changing the narrative. Obviously, we've spent countless episodes on discussing this topic of narrative. So I think this is definitely worth having a go at as well. I'm, of course, not surprised by the value of combining the two. We know that, as you said, and what we do, if I just take our own returns, even back to the 80s, and combine it with S&P 500, what always surprises me, and I think it surprises the people when they see it, is because you kind of expect, okay, if you take 50% trend and 50% done, you get kind of an average, but actually you almost get the sum of the two because the compound effect is so high. That I think shocks people when they see it for the first time. And the other thing is, I think you're right that maybe investors would be more open to the idea of the term overlay. We know certainly pension funds, as far as I recall, you know, they've used currency overlays and different types of overlays to their strategies, to their portfolio. So maybe a return enhancing overlay would be good to propose to them. One thing I wanted to ask you is, because we've been so focused on the crisis alpha aspects, we have certain metrics that we kind of focus on when we try and showcase that. Are there any, if we were to go down this route and try and get people interested in the overlay side of things, are there any different metrics, measures that we should point them towards?
I think there is that perception that it's just, that there's like an inherent cost to this protection, and there's a cost associated with trend following. So I mean, by virtue of showing the returns, and that it's not just something to be a drag on your portfolio and then dampen vol, but it's actually a proactive, additive feature, and also the systematic element means it's facilitating staying in the equity market, I guess, or it's, you know, rather than so I think it's that characteristic as much as anything else. We can talk about the return characteristics, but it's also the fundamental characteristic of the strategy being trend following and systematic, that maybe that has to be emphasized, and as a way of participating in the equity market without, you know, having to try infer from all of the noise as to when the market's going to turn in, which will at some point. We all know there will be a significant drawdown at some point, but and as we're saying, the risks are rising, but whether it's going to be in a month's time or a year's time or 2 years, who knows, you know?
You'll relate to this, Alan. I back in the 90s, I had a colleague called Tom, and Tom used to work at the Virginia Retirement System. And the Virginia Retirement System was very important for our industry because it was really, I think, the first pension, maybe not the first pension fund, but they were very vocal about implementing a portfolio of fund of funds in the CTA space back in the 90s, I think. And he had a great line. He said, well, people should realize that, and whether he said managed futures or trend following or CTAs, I don't know, but let's just call it trend following. He said, what people should realize is that trend following allows them to own equities. And I think that's, I mean, it's so true, but we never talk about it in that way. But that's exactly what it does. All right, so we've covered a few different topics and we're going to take a little bit of a detour to a topic that fascinates me in many respects. Not entirely sure I can fully understand how they magically can take out all the bad stuff and get left with a very smooth return stream. And we are not talking about private equity this time because we know how they do it. But we are talking about multi-strategy funds because you saw a paper. Well, no, you didn't see the paper. You saw the person who wrote the paper, Brian Hurst, give a presentation about this. So again, very excited to hear about this topic.
Yeah, like yourself, I've been very curious about this space and, you know, the growth of assets, the consistency of returns, and, you know, wondering what's going on. You know, curious to learn more about it. And Brian Hurst from Clear Alpha. Brian used to be at AQR and for many years left there and has started a multi-manager, multi-strat firm in the last year. I saw him give a presentation on this topic, and there is a paper for anybody interested on their website. And it's you know, it starts off talking about, you know, how multi-manager funds with full pass-through fees. You know, how their returns.
Can you explain that? Maybe people don't quite understand. What do they mean by full pass-through?
Yeah, so full pass-through means basically all of the costs. So multi-manager funds obviously have big teams of portfolio managers called pods. So each individual team is called a pod. You know, I understand the likes of Millennium can have up to 300 pods, but, you know, it could be anywhere from 20, 50 to 100 or more. And basically, you know, in the old fund of funds type model, the underlying manager had a fee and the fund of funds had a fee, and that was all wrapped up together in terms of the management fees. In this model, basically all of the expenses associated with all of the managers, as well as the their kind of performance fees, are passed through. So it's kind of, it's more of a platform is how it's positioned. So all of the kind of sign-on costs associated with the individual pods flow through to the underlying investors. So it's like you're participating in the overall profit and loss of the platform. You're subjected to all of the cost. And then out of that as well comes the performance fees that for the individual managers. So it's a different model than saying we're just going to charge, you know, 2% management fee and 2% of performance fees, and the fund provider will take care of all the costs. It's a different model of the view to say we're going to pass through all of the fees and expenses, but that will allow us to attract better talent. So
sorry to interrupt you here, Alan. I'm really just curious. Have you come across any studies that actually have calculated what are these fees? I mean, if you calculate it into a management fee, meaning fixed cost and performance fee, like we do, we know that it's not, obviously, I mean, everybody says 2 and 20, but it's not 2 and 20 anymore in our world. But let's just call it, you know, 1.5 and 15 on average, whatever. Do you know what it would equate to?
I haven't seen any studies, but I understand it's like up to 7, 8, 9, 10% of fees.
I've always, they make it sound like this is an advantage, but I don't see any advantage in this from a fee perspective. So that's really the, talk about a narrative. I mean, they've been incredibly successful. Okay, backed up by some numbers. Okay, fine. But they've been very successful in creating this aura around, oh, it's not a problem that we're paying $10 million to this guy as a sign-on bonus. But clearly all of those costs, if it was a manager, the manager has to pay that, not the client. So it doesn't strike me as being advantageous to the underlying investor whatsoever. But maybe it's overcome by the fact that they can apply more leverage and what have
you. No, you're right. I mean, it's something that you would have thought would be a big stumbling block, but obviously they've been able to overcome it in terms of performance. And so this paper looks at, it starts off by highlighting that the returns have been better. These funds have generated more alpha, stronger sharps than hedge funds more generally. And then is asking, why is that the case? And I guess, sometimes the standard answer on this is better able to attract talent and compensate managers and have good risk management so they know when to cut managers quickly. And I suppose the key point about the paper is I was kind of maybe a little bit surprised. I thought I might learn something more. But I mean, it was interesting that from Brian Hurst's perspective, it really is the structural construction of the portfolios of basically finding uncorrelated strategies and applying leverage. And that's it. You know what I mean? And that's the same idea of blending uncorrelated strategies. The old fund of funds obviously didn't apply the leverage, and that's where they came unstuck, in the sense of, you blended strategies together and suddenly the vol was down to 3 or 4%. So you needed high sharps. But they're taking the same basic idea, but just applying it to the nth degree, in the sense of having hundreds of pods and leveraging up. Now, this paper is all about just showing the mathematics of how it works, and it's all very clear and fairly obvious. It relies on finding good strategies. They don't have to be rock stars. I mean, good, he's calling like a 0.7, 0.75 sharp. I mean, in our world, in CTAs, we'd call that very respectable, but not necessarily two sharps. But if you find, 20 of those sharps, 20 of those strategies with a 0.7 sharp, and they're all lowly correlated, as he says, I think that's 0 to 0.1, then obviously the numbers suddenly become very good with the application of leverage. And that makes sense. I think, obviously, what to make of that. Are there a lot of these types of strategies out there? Obviously, that there are some strategies which periodically offer very nice returns. Like the popular strategies in this space are things like the basis trade, where you're buying the treasury bonds and selling the futures, and that at various times they trade. There's a premium to be extracted, and you can apply leverage. And it's pretty close to risk-free money. Other things to do are things like index rebalancing. I mean, in some shops, there's a lot more long-short equity. But there's obviously a constant search to find all of these strategies that have that level of sharp. What was interesting in the paper is that he does point out that there is this sensitivity to correlation, that it works very well if you have lowly correlated strategies. But as soon as the correlation starts to rise, then the portfolio volatility starts to pick up. So you're going to have to allocate from some managers to hit your target volatility. And then the second thing is, it's not just about the average correlation, but it's about the correlation in the tails. So I think this is an important point to think about when looking at this space is, you don't think in terms of average correlation, but think of what can happen in the worst case scenario. And the worst thing that can happen is, if a lot of these pods have the same strategies, and then there's a problem and they start to suffer a loss, and then obviously when their assets go down, you have to rebalance the portfolio and degross a bit. And then if everybody is doing that at the same time, then that can push the market, and then you can get into a potentially crisis event. So this is kind of like the type of scenario we saw in 2007 with the quant crisis. You might remember, I think it was August 07, where basically a lot of long short funds had a similar position. So critical to doing the multi-manager approach well is making sure you don't have the same exposures in everywhere as everybody else, and not overly exposed to individual factors. So the risk management, the platform, being able to look into the individual pods, and I understand they do actively, rebalance. So if a load of pods are long Apple, they might take an offsetting position against that. So that's part of the magic. But certainly you could see in scenarios of where it could come unstuck. And obviously March 2020 is an example of that. There was large basis trades, and obviously we were in the midst of COVID. in that time, the Fed came in and basically bailed out the whole system. Will they always do that? Who knows? Maybe, maybe not. But that's the type of scenario where you could see more of a challenge, I think, for these types of strategies.
Yeah, no, fascinating stuff. Definitely something that I think both you and I would like to talk more about, in the sense that we were actually approached by one of the big multi-strat funds. And I think both of us are open to doing a mini series on that, but we definitely need a few more of the larger names to come forward and be open to have a conversation like we did with the CTAs. I think it could be a good one, but we can't just focus on one or two entities. We need to have a little bit of a broad spectrum. So if any of you listening today are working for some of the big multi-strat firms and have contacts up in the hierarchy, reach out to us, usual email address, info@toptradersonblock.com, and we'll pick it up from there and see if we can create something of value for you, the listener. Thank you so much, Alan. This was great. This was fascinating, and appreciate all the preparations you did. I was telling you yesterday that my day changed a lot, so I didn't have as much time to prepare as usual. But I guess nowadays we talk so much about AI. I guess I could just plug in a few topics and all the preparation will be done
exactly.
For me. But and maybe if I just use the new ChatGPT 4.0, all the questions will come in the voice of Scarlett Johansson, if you follow the narrative out there. Anyways, we'll be back as always next week. And I'm going to be back with Katie, and I think this will be an interesting one because she may talk about something she have not talked about before, because they are launching some new product, which I'm excited to learn more about, and I think it could be quite useful to hear her perspective on this. So I'll leave it at that. If you have questions for Katie, as always, info@toptradersonblock.com. And I will do my very best to bring them on the show. From Alan and me, thanks ever so much for listening. We look forward to being back with you next week. And in the meantime, as usual, take care of yourself and take care of each other.
Thanks for listening to the Systematic Investor Podcast Series. If you enjoy this series, go on over to iTunes and leave an honest rating and review. And be sure to listen to all the other episodes from Top Traders Unplugged. If you have questions about systematic investing, send us an email with the word question in the subject line to info@toptradersunplugged.com, and we'll try to get it on the show. And remember, all the discussion that we have about investment performance is about the past, and past performance does not guarantee or even infer anything about future performance. Also understand that there's a significant risk of financial loss with all investment strategies, and you need to request and understand the specific risks from the investment manager about their products before you make investment decisions. Thanks for spending some of your valuable time with us, and we'll see you on the next episode of The Systematic Investor.